Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
You can host the best backyard barbecue when you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside. Repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Hey guys, it's Mark Striegel. We have a great episode. Scott Travis is here with us and also Jim Bakke. So please stay tuned for long interviews with both of these guys. One famous guy who has been a long history in the history of hard rock and heavy metal, that would be Scott Travis. One not so famous guy who also has a long history as far as hard rock and heavy metal go. That guy would be Jim Bakke. So stay tuned for both these interviews. We'll obviously start first with the Scott Travis interview. I just wanted to mention before we get into the show to please support Talking Metal. You can do this by making a PayPal donation, and the place you can do that is paypal.me/Mark, that's M-A-R-K, Striegel, S-T-R-I-G-L, paypal.me/Mark Striegel, M-A-R-K-S-T-R-I-G-L, and you can also support us by using our Amazon links, no matter what country you're in, America, you know, North America, in Canada, or the United States, or the UK, we have Amazon links for all these places. And guys, please, especially from Canada and the UK, we need you to jump on this and use these links. The other way you can support is by leaving me a message of encouragement. I have a bunch of them. I'm going to play them soon. 973-757-1917 is where you do that. Please leave me a message. You can follow me on Snapchat. It's Talking Metal, the number 4U. Emily Striegel and I run that account. There's a Talking Metal Instagram. There are Talking Metal Twitter accounts at Talking Metal and at Striegel, S-T-R-I-G-L. You can leave us a 5-star review on iTunes. But really what I need from you guys right now is the PayPal donations and the Amazon links, using those Amazon links, and also our Patreon account, patreon.com/talkingmetal. Please support us there with a monthly pledge. I was recently laid off from my job in early December. It's been a hard month. And I spend a ton of money on this website, and I'm, for the first time in a long time, I'm worried about this podcast and this website. I don't know if I can continue to afford to pay all the money for, you know, Spreaker and the CD the host baby costs and the GoDaddy costs if I have no income. I'm desperately trying to get a job. A, so I can support my family, and B, so I can continue doing this great thing that I've been doing since 2005, Talking Metal. Guys, if there's ever been a time in the history of this podcast to show some support, it's now. And I hope we can continue doing what we do here. But again, I'm starting to freak out a little bit. So anyways, that's that. And on that cheerful news, here we go. This is a brand new episode of Talking Metal.
Mark Striegel,
John Astronomy,
the Talking Metal Podcast, coming to you from the Silver Spacecraft. I'm Bud Friendly, and now your hosts, Mark and John.
Man,
Hey, welcome to another edition of the Talking Metal Podcast. My name is Mark Striegel, and I am joined by co-host, co-founder, the co-pilot of this episode and of Talking Metal, John Astronomy. How are you?
I am doing great, Mark.
Happy New Year, man. I haven't spoken yet.
Yeah, 2018, Happy New Year.
Yeah.
Ready for a great 2018 filled with talking metal, regular metal, and all things metal.
Absolutely. Cool. We have some great guests on today's show. Scott Travis, in one of his first interviews since the announcement of the new Judas Priest record, we're going to talk to him all about that. I actually recorded this this interview in Epic Records in New York City. Oh, I don't know. It had to be a month ago at this point.
And
maybe less. I'm not sure. Yeah, I guess three to four weeks ago in New York City, I recorded this. And it's great, man. They played me the entire Judas Priest record, the new record, before anyone had heard it. I was one of the first guys there on the first day of interview. So I truly believe that I was possibly, outside of people in the inner circle, one of the first people in the world to hear the record.
Yeah, and that's great.
It's great stuff, John. It's really, they're not inventing anything new with this record, and that's a good thing. What they're doing is revisiting all eras of their sounds throughout their career, and you're going to hear stuff that you haven't heard Priest do in a long time. You're going to get everything you, as the Judas Priest fan, wants from this record. I am really excited to hear this record again. I've only heard it once, and it blew my mind. And I will say that I heard every song but one when I was there. There was one they didn't play me, and that was simply because Scott was ready to do an interview with me, and I had to be pulled out of the private listening room that I was in listening to the record to go talk with him. And do you remember, you and I interviewed him years ago. It had to be probably 10, 11 years ago. Do you remember that?
Yeah, I do. And I remember a bunch of different things with Scott Travis. I remember he was at the Gibson showroom, and I don't think that was the day we interviewed him, but he was there doing VH1 Rock Honor stuff, and Ace and Peter were there that day. And I remember taking photographs of Scott that ended up on the Gibson.com website, and that was really cool.
Wow, cool.
And then I ran into Scott dressed in the astronomy suit, believe it or not, on the red carpet for VH1 Rock Honors.
Right, okay. The astronomy suit, to anybody who doesn't know, is John used to. I don't think you've put it on in a while, but you used to. It was a silver outfit, and it was kind of your rock star persona, if you will, right?
Yeah. And you hear something really funny. Scott initially thought I said cocking metal instead of talking metal.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, that was really, he goes, what's your show called? Cocking metal? I go, no, talking metal. So that was really funny. But Scott's an amazing drummer, and me being a drummer, I'm just always been impressed by Scott and his playing. It's great that he's been in Priest for so long at this point now, you know? It's not like one of these bands that switch people out every day. I don't like that.
Yeah, he's been with them a long time. We're going to talk to him about his history with Judas Priest, his musical history in general, and of course the brand new Judas Priest record, Firepower, which is coming out on March 13th. Actually, that's not correct. The tour starts on March 13th. The album, I believe, also comes out in March. You can pre-order it now. We're going to have links up in today's show notes on TalkingMetal.com where you can do that. And yeah, there's some cool stuff. Like if you pre-order it through Pledge Music, you can get the album and also a limited edition colored vinyl version of it, autograph vinyl test pressings, an exclusive Judas Priest t-shirt, and an extremely limited number of Judas Priest autograph guitars. That's all available through Pledge Music for this new Judas Priest record. There's a brand new music video out for, I guess I would call it, the first single off the record. It's called Lightning Strikes. They actually played me this video when I was at Epic Records a month ago, before they played me the record. And it's a great song. What a way to start the excitement about the new record. record, Lightning Strikes. This is available on iTunes. It's out. It came out on the 5th of January. Go download the song in full. This is just a short 90-second sample of the song. So go buy it on iTunes and support Judas Priest. After we hear this little 90-second sound sample of the song Lightning Strikes, we will be hearing from Scott Travis and myself, recorded in New York City at the end of 2017. Here we go.
Bit like Bob Coburn.
Oh, yeah.
Have you heard that before?
I actually did hear that maybe once or twice, but it's been a while. But
that's how we start interviews.
Rockline. Yeah, I used to love that show. I used to love that show. Check one, two. Give me a 1-2.
Check 1-2. Bob Coburn here.
Hey, it's Mark Striegel of Talking Metal, and I am in New York City where I just heard the brand new Priest record, Firepower. And wow, I am still digesting all this as I sit with Scott Travis,
yes,
the drummer of Judas Priest. What an honor. Scott, thanks for having me here and playing me the new record.
Thank you, man. Thank you for interviewing us.
Oh, you bet. I mean, this, again, I just heard almost all this new record, which I'm still digesting, but one of the things that really stuck out to me about it was how organically it seems to weave the history of Judas Priest into one listening experience. Just from Painkiller to Sad Wings of Destiny to even, like, there was stuff on there I heard that reminded me of something that could have come off of Point of Entry. And sometimes this stuff all happens within one song. How did it work when you guys were putting these song ideas together? Was that a conscious effort that we kind of need to go back and revisit the greatness of our past? Or was this just something that kind of happened organically and naturally?
I would say it's a little bit of both. Obviously, you'd have to ask that of Richie and Rob and Glenn as far as, you know, did they intentionally write some guitar parts like that? But keep in mind, Richie certainly wasn't part of those old records,
right,
and neither was I. So I don't know if it was a conscious effort really on their writing behalf. But from recording and then obviously having Andy Sneap and Tom Allum. Now, Tom Allum was part of the old Priest heritage and the Priest sound, so to speak. And so he was able to, I think, incorporate and bring some of that old style back. And then Andy also, even though he's what I will call a modern day producer, he's a big Priest fan, and he lived on the lineage and just understood the Priest world and the heritage of Priest. So he was a big fan of the older records and the older sound. So definitely was a conscious effort on on their parts as well as ours, you know, in the performing aspect of it. I mean, even some of the drum stuff I did, you know, I wanted to borrow a little bit of Les Binks.
Les Binks, sure.
You know, some of his influence, which I'm a big fan of his anyways from way back in the day. So, yeah, it was conscious, but I don't know if it was written in there like that. Maybe, hopefully, it just came out of that way, or came out that way, you know, like you said, organically, which was cool that you were able to recognize that.
Yeah, I mean, even the vocal stylings, like I hear, like on songs like I think Sea of Red, which has this softer side to it, at least in some of the song, and Rise from Ruins, I think was another one where I haven't heard Rob sing like he sings in those verses for decades, really. I mean, there was just this real, just clean, sing-songy type of vibe to his voice, beautiful sounding, yeah. And just so refreshing to hear that. Yeah, just really loving the record, and I can't wait for the Talking Metal listeners to check this out. When you look over these new tracks, what are some of the ones that jump out as your favorites?
Interesting you should ask that, because Rob and I were doing an interview earlier today, and I made the point that I've moved around a bit on my favorites on this record, meaning that when I first heard some of the early demos, you know, you have favorites and you like certain hooks or verses or choruses or whatever. And then as a drummer, then I'm in the studio playing the songs, and then again, there may be some different songs like, wow, I really love this groove, or I love playing this, you know, slamming through this with Richie and playing the double bass part. And then, full circle, then you hear, quote unquote, the finished product after more layers of guitars and vocals have been put on, it's been mixed and produced a little bit. And then, obviously, I'm listening to the finished product, and then I have new favorites at that point. So, to answer your question after that long-winded intro, I really like Rising from Ruins is probably, yeah. if you put a gun to my head and said, what's your favorite? That would be on there. Lone Wolf, Evil Never Dies is just a cool, simple, you know, straight ahead rock priest tune. Never the Heroes, I think, is a great, meaningful song in the sense, just lyrically, even though I have nothing to do with the lyrics, but it's just a really, it's a great song. And I think,
great,
you
hook
know,
on that one.
Yeah,
too,
it's a great hook. Dude, you know, I'm glad to hear you recognize. And again, I know it must be difficult to hear something for the first time, especially if it's 14 songs. That's a lot to digest. But the record does have a lot of ebbs and flows, and hopefully has some movement to it where, you know, not the first song doesn't sound like the fifth song, sounds like the eighth song. Hopefully there's some different sounds and just vibes that people are going to get when they listen to it.
You know, Rising from Ruins, which you mentioned, has this beautiful intro, which I guess you guys are calling Guardians, like a musical instrumental that almost sounds like something like classic Queen, you know, before it has this piano and then these almost Brian May-esque guitars that come in. Great, great stuff. You guys recently, I'm assuming it was recently, shot a music video, which I also got a sneak peek at. Where do music videos, what do they do for you guys nowadays? I mean, it's such a different time than when music videos were released and MTV would play them and, you know, VH1 and stuff. Are they still a necessity? Do you still enjoy doing them? What are your thoughts on music videos in 2017?
Well, let me address this one first. I have not seen the video.
It's good. It's really good.
Well, I think that it was older footage of us on tour 2 or 3 years ago, because obviously we haven't toured in a number of years now. So I think it was older footage that was married to the audio track of this song. So clearly it's not us really playing the song, and hopefully, you know, that's not what it appears to. Is that what it appears to look like we're playing the song?
It to me, it looked like that, but looked like there were some clips that were possibly from live performances.
Yeah,
so you didn't go to a sound stage and shoot?
No,
okay.
No. And I don't think, like I said, I don't think that's the intent to try and make it look like that. But like I said, I have not seen the video, so I probably shouldn't even comment. But I will answer your question in this regard. I mean, I think videos are super important nowadays, more so really than ever, because everybody, I'm holding up my phone even though I can't see it, everybody has one of these, and it's literally a computer and a TV in your phone, I mean, in your hand. And people want to see things as well as hear it nowadays, you know? So I think it's important to have some visual cues, we'll call them, just visual things for people to digest along with audio. And we got to do more of it, in my opinion.
In the studio on this record, you had two producers, right? Tom and Andy, who mm-hmm. you mentioned. What was the dynamic like them? Were they both there in person? Was there a pull, yin and yang type of thing? But between them, how did they work together as a team, your opinion? What did you witness?
Surprisingly, they worked really, really well. And I say surprising only because they had never worked together. And we, meaning the band, we don't know how people are going to get together, whether it's how they're going to get along, whether it's an engineer or producers or whatever. And I would like to mention, speaking of engineers, Mike Exeter, who worked on Redeemer of Souls with us, and he did some work with Black Sabbath on their 7 album.
Cool.
But he's a super cool guy. And so we really had three, engineers/producers working on it. But no, Tom and Andy got along great. They were both in the studio all the time. And no, there was no yin and yang. I mean, obviously, there's going to, at some point, somebody's opinion is going to differ from another, but there was never any arguments or
right.
nothing even remotely close to that. I mean, everything always, got agreed upon after extensive listening and options and things like that. That's the main thing to do also, is to have options. I'd asked for a Dr. Pepper, and suddenly a Dr. Pepper appears.
Oh, well,
look
we
at
go.
That. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
And on Talking Metal, do I have to talk like a metal, or can I just do normal voices?
You're doing fine. Okay, you're doing fine.
When you hear Talking Metal, you think you got to talk metal. Anyways, that was a joke. But anyways, it was really smooth, and I was happy because I had never been able to work with Tom Allum in the past. Obviously, he was doing the Priest stuff before I joined the band, so it was really cool to be able to work with him.
Awesome. I'm very excited. I just bought my tickets for the show in Newark, New Jersey. Saxon, Black Star Riders, which is kind of the Thin Lizzy offshoot, who you did some work Thin Lizzy, which mm-hmm. we can talk about. But to me, after hearing this record today, that is the perfect tour to go out and support this record. Because like we said, you're kind of revisiting different eras of the band with this record, which I think the longtime fans are going to love. Was there, I don't know how involved you were with picking your touring mates of Saxon and Black Star Riders, but was there an overall thought that we need to have some contemporaries on the bill with us who are going to appeal to people who are the longtime Priest fan?
Yes. Well, when you say contemporaries, you mean contemporaries, our contemporaries,
well,
or new?
Well, I mean that you're not going out with Trivium or Avenged Sevenfold. You're going out. You guys were a lot bigger than at least Saxon ever was. Priest was, but still, Saxon is a band that I saw when I was 14 years old,
me
as
too.
Is Priest, and to me, this whole night, I mean, I'm going to be there from the second the lights go down for
right.
whoever's playing first. I think it's Black Star Rider. So
yeah.
I can just experience this whole night. I was so excited because, when Metallica toured recently, to me, I don't know, the bands that they had on with them weren't really bands that were a part of my musical history. And it was, the audience response was kind of weird. But to me, this grouping seems just perfect, at least for guys like me who have been longtime metal fans, longtime Priest
fans.
Well,
dude, that's great to hear, because honestly, you are our target audience in the sense that we want to appeal to the traditional heavy metal fan. And of course, like you said, Saxon being a longtime English heavy metal band, and they certainly have some classic songs. And Scott Gorham and Black Star Rider, I mean, he's a classic legendary guitar player,
yeah.
So we love having them. And we've toured with those guys a few years. Well, both bands, we've toured with them before. So we get along with them, and they get along, and it's great musically. Like you said, we want to keep it, on the upper shelf as far as bands that have some history within them, and make it a real heavy metal show. So hopefully people will appreciate and come out and support.
Cool. And let's talk also about some of your history. You obviously started off way back when with a band that really just spawned so much heavy metal and hard rock history, Racer X. Paul Gilbert, Bruce Bouye was in there. You had, Jeff and John. All these guys have gone on to do so much stuff. Do you have any contact with any of them?
Yeah, all the time. I see Jeff Martin. He lives in Lake Tahoe. and I still communicate with John Alderetti. Bruce, not as much, even though I've seen him on Instagram and stuff, and Paul, not so much either. He's a different bird.
Yeah.
But yeah, you're right. You know, there's a funny little trivia question in there. Did you know the Racer X has 3 Grammy winners within that band? So if
really?
You ever
wow.
wanted somebody wanted to do a trivia, you go, what heavy
well,
metal?
You.
John Alderetti won one with Mars Volta.
Okay, right.
And Bruce
okay.
Boyer won a production Grammy for a Motorhead album he did.
Oh, that's right, right. It was a Motorhead cover of a Metallica song, Whiplash, I think.
Something
yeah,
like
yeah,
yeah.
Yeah, but with Bob Kulick.
Yeah, exactly.
Was, yeah, dual producer.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And because yeah. I did have one of two of those tribute albums with Bruce and Bob. I think
right.
I did a Kiss one for a second, where they would just bring in a bunch of different musicians playing different songs. But anyways, yeah, that's a little bit of trivia. Because obviously, you know, Racer X, we couldn't get arrested back in the 80s, so we never really achieved much success outside of Los Angeles. But it's just ironic, like you said, that little band from LA in the 80s spawned, you know, the musicians and some of the credits that we did. But
and was also kind of, if correct me if I'm wrong, but it was your gateway into Judas Priest.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah,
yeah,
the story, the shortest story I can deliver is that Jeff Martin, the singer in Racer X, he was casual friends with Rob Halford. They both lived in Phoenix at the time, and Jeff was in a band, or prior to Racer X, Jeff was in a band called Surgical Steel. Sorry, I had a brain moment
right.
there. He was in Surgical Steel, based in Phoenix. Rob lived in Phoenix, and they just were mutual friends. You know, Rob would go out and see the band once in a while and sing with them and yada yada. So one day, Rob calls Jeff and says, Dave Holland's left the band, and we're looking for drummers, and what's Scott doing? You know, because
yeah.
they had heard again, being mutual friends, every time Jeff got a new Racer X album, he would send it to Rob saying, here's our new product, check it out, as friends do. You know, here's my
right.
new shit, listen to it. So Rob and the band were aware of the Racer X material. And
you actually covered what at the time was an unreleased Judas Priest song. Yeah.
Yeah. And actually, the cool thing was, it was a great song. And we actually got a little bit of airplay locally on KNAC, the local heavy metal radio station in Los Angeles. They played it on the airwaves, you know, a number of times. And full circle, then years later, Priest redoes, like, yeah, I think we'll have that song back. I'm like,
yeah.
dude, come on. Like, well, you know. But yeah, it was their song. And at the time, I guess they just weren't interested. And then when they heard, you know, I think they wanted to redo it after a while.
Cool. And, you know,
it was not as good, of course, but whatever.
You also, when Priest kind of, the Priest version wasn't as good as the
Yeah,
Missouri.
I'm joking, because obviously they wrote it first, and we heard their demo version, and then we whipped up our own little version, and then, of course.
And then I think Rob did a version of it with Halford.
Did he?
Wow. It's like a bonus track or
something.
Yeah,
well, there you go. It's funny, you know, one man's trash is somebody else's treasure, you know, so that little song got a lot of mileage.
You left Judas Priest when the band, I don't know if left is the right word, because you maybe never truly left, but you went with Rob Halford to do Fight.
Well, the singer
right?
quit. Yeah, when the singer quits your band, you got a momentary decision to make as far as, well, hey, the band. No. Rob had left the band in 1991.
Right.
And luckily he asked me to be a part of his new band, which was called Fight. And I, you know, asked the guys in Priest, KK and Ian and Glenn, and said, hey, you know, Rob's asked me to join him. Do you guys have a problem with him? And they said, no, absolutely. We prefer you to do it, actually, just to keep, you know, keep it all in the family, so to speak. And they weren't sure what they were going to do at the time.
Right.
And so, yeah, it worked out.
And did Fight finish before Judas Priest was kind of gearing up to do more stuff
again,
with Ripper?
Yeah, again,
was it
the time
kind of finished.
Yeah, it had its natural rise and fall, if you will. In other words, we did 2 records, and then after that, the label said, "No, thank you. You know, we're not interested in a third." And then so that was basically the end of Fight, and that was around 94, 95, I believe. And at that time, Priest was ready to get reinvigorated or get back in the saddle, whatever you want to call it. And so they flew me over to England, and I ended up bringing the demo, the VHS live performance of Ripper Owens singing in his band British Steel.
Cool.
cool. And, you know, Jugulator just turned 20 years old just last month. How do you look back on that record and just your time with Ripper in general? It was kind of, as a fan, no disrespect, but it was kind of a weird time for me and my relationship with Priest.
I can understand that. And but the only thing I'll say in defense of any band that has to do that, you know, unless someone passes away, which is would be unfortunate for any band, bands typically have two choices. You can either fold up and never do anything again, or you can try and find a new singer and carry on. So obviously Priest chose the latter, and it was cool. Obviously we weren't playing as big of places, but we still were productive and we put out some records and that was it, you know.
Right on.
It's rock and roll at the end of the day. So what you want to do, what I want to do personally as a musician, is you want to create music with people you get along with. You want it to be in the same genre of music that you really like. In other words, you don't want to sell out and do, you know, shit that you don't want to play.
Right.
And then you obviously want to go on tour and play for the fans. And we accomplished all those things.
Very good. Do you hear much from KK Downing? Is he somebody that you or anyone in the band hears much from these days?
No.
No.
Mm-mm.
No. No contact. No, no.
No, and it's not out of any sort of acrimony, or, I mean, I don't certainly have any problem with KK, and don't think he has any with me. It's just that, you know, we just don't have anything, you know, to talk about or communicate with, you know. I mean, I liked him when he was in the band. We got along, and obviously, you know, they hired me, so if he didn't like me, I'm sure I would have been gone a long time ago. But anyways, it's just the way things evolve, you know.
Yeah.
Relationships, you know what I mean. It's like,
yes,
you're friends with people and you're in a band with them, and then when they leave the band or the band breaks or whatever the case is, you just don't talk as much as you used to.
Yeah. And let's talk about Richie Faulkner's involvement with this new album, kind of circle back to the Firepower record, which, again, guys, I just heard, and I really think it's, again, I'm just digesting it all, but to me it seems like your strongest output since Painkiller. I mean, I really am excited by this and can't wait for the listeners to hear this. Richie, primary songwriter at this point. Is that fair to say on the new record?
Yeah, he's young and got a lot of ideas, and he's adept at, you know, looking at your laptop over there, but he's adept at, you know, being able to be on the road or in a hotel room or backstage and plug in those little apps and jukeboxes and shit and put ideas down, you know, on a laptop and be able to carry him around and introduce him to us and stuff like that. So yeah, he's prolific in that regard, and he's got a lot of great ideas.
For me, when I listened to this record and I compared it to Redeemer of Souls, I'm hearing in a different production, and I'm sure a lot of that is Tom and Andy, but I was just wondering. To me, it's a little bit of a bigger sound than Redeemer of Souls, warmer in a good way, like almost analog, you know, that old warm sound, clearer, and the guitar sound just sounds brilliant. It's so good. How do you compare this record to Redeemer of Souls? What differences do you see in the record?
By the way, that's my Dr. Pepper.
Right.
Why do I keep mentioning that stupid name? They should give me an endorsement.
Yeah, they should. Yeah.
Anyways, and you can cut all that out if you want. But, obviously we have two different producers on this record that we didn't have on Redeemer. So anytime you change producers, you're automatically going to get a different sound. And that's usually what bands are looking for. That's why you hire different producers. So, yes, again, great of you to recognize that. And we did record in a much more organic way than I'd certainly done since Painkiller.
Really?
I have to say that, yeah. So, again, hopefully that translates and comes through on the recording that you and the fans will be able to hear and appreciate and hopefully like. And that's it. Like I said, Andy's great, and he knows how to get, you know, great modern sounds, drums, guitars, and yada yada. He's a guitar player himself, so that's why the guitars are so goddamn loud, but that's just me.
Yeah.
I'm kidding. But anyways, proof is in the pudding. You have new producers, you're going to have a new sound.
Yeah. A couple songs we'll just hit upon, and then we'll wrap it up. Sea of Red, which I believe is going to close out the record. To me, this I would call it a simple song, but so beautiful and powerful. How does a song like that come together? Because when I listen to the chords, like if Richie were to play me, I mean, I'm a nobody who knows nothing, but just those chords on a laptop, they don't sound, I would have been like, oh, that's nothing. But yet, when the drums, the just incredibly powerful vocals on this song all come together as one, it just really makes it just this magical moment that closes out the record. I guess my question is, how does a song like that come together? Is that just a vibe in the studio with all you guys kind of coming together as one, or is it more pieced together? Like, how does a songwriting process work on that specific song?
Yeah, it's obviously a little bit of all of that. I mean, if Richie comes up with a guitar riff and then Rob's going to have a vocal idea at some point, melody and lyrically, there's the nucleus, you know, there's the start of a song. And getting back to what you were saying earlier about some of the other songs and the variation in Rob's voice and how I think you used the word beautiful, which is certainly apropos, because Rob is excellent. I mean, again, I'm going to say something that's Captain Obvious. I mean, Rob is a really phenomenal singer.
Right.
Not just a heavy metal singer, not just a rock. Rob's a great, great singer.
Absolutely.
And they ain't growing on trees.
Yeah.
And with his age, he seems to have gotten better. And, you know, this album, I think, really showcases him as well as the guitars and everyone else. I mean, it really is a showcase for Rob Halford, because he is a great singer. He deserves to be able to be heard in all these different environments and different textures and different, like you said, just, you know, different melodies and things like that. So specifically about that song, I mean, I can't say exactly, you know, how what they were thinking when they came up with those parts. You should ask them. But I do know in the nucleus of the whole record that, again, it's, you know, it's a combination of a little bit of everything. I mean,
yeah,
again,
what a beautiful track that is.
Thank you.
Yeah. And just to end things here today with Scott Travis in New York City, we are talking Firepower, which comes out in March. Judas Priest, definitely catch them with Saxon and Black Star Riders. I know I will be there at the Newark show. But just to end things with a thought, you know, Judas Priest, their catalog has had some different drummers. And, you know, I when you came into the band with Painkiller, your style is all over that record, as it is Firepower. But Les Binks, to me, a guy you mentioned earlier, his style is all over some classic 70s era.
Absolutely.
Judas Priest stuff. I'm not a drummer, so I'm asking you, what made his style so unique? Was there a swing going that maybe Dave Holland didn't quite have? Because there was like almost a groove. Am I right about that?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Again, I don't know Les Banks, never met him, but I mean, clearly it sounds like he had some jazz influence with his schooling, or, you know, just his upbringing on the drums, we'll call it. So he definitely incorporated some of that, but then he also had the cool double bass and the heavy metal aspect, and he obviously threw that in there. But I agree with you. I mean, he's my favorite Priest drummer, and all I ever say is Exciter. That's it. When I heard that song, I was like, I'm done. This is that. Is fucking killer. It's my favorite band. It's my favorite song. So obviously he's a big influence on me, and on even on this record, like I mentioned earlier, and you picked out, we tried to bring in some of those old influences, you know, of the old Les Binks era and Dave Holland and everything within Priest, and hopefully captured all on one new modern sounding record. So
you did it.
Cool.
Thanks,
thank
Scott.
You very much.
Scott Travis, Judas Priest, guys.
All right.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Time.
That's Rock Forever off the Hellbent for Leather record, which was released February 28th, 1979. It was released in 1978, actually, under a different name in other parts of the world. It was called Killing Machine in Europe, I believe. And that features Les Binks on the drums. John, you were mentioning that you were a big fan as a drummer. You're a big fan of Scott Travis and his drumming. Well, Scott is a big fan of Les Binks. He loves Les Binks playing. We were actually talking about that in the interview. And great, great record right there. Hellbent for Leather by Judas Priest featuring Les Binks on drums. Again, that song, Rock Forever. Definitely pick that up. John, besides Scott, who are some of your other favorite drummers?
I have a lot of favorite drummers, and they all have different styles. So I grew up listening to Peter Criss and then Eric Carr, who are Peter's a little more jazzy in his early days. Eric Carr is more of a John Bonham style. Those were my favorite two drummers. Anton Figg, to me, I think he might be the world's greatest all-around drummer. He can play A-style music. He can play with Miles Davis. He can play with anyone. And I love his playing. He is literally, possibly, in my opinion, he's definitely one of the best drummers out there. I've always liked Neil Peart. I like Vinnie Paul. I've liked Tommy Lee, Blas Elias. There's just a lot of great guys, and they're all different genres. I'm not a guy who just likes one specific style of drumming.
Right on. Cool. Yeah.
Hey,
I mean,
I got a little surprise for you.
Yeah. What do you got?
I got a surprise for you. You have to check your telephone right now. I texted you a never before seen photo, and it's really cool for a lot of reasons. And I'll tell you why when you look at it. Do you have your photo?
Yeah. Wow,
your phone
wow.
handy?
Yeah. I'm actually seeing this just for the first time. Rob Halford and Ace. Wow. Very cool.
Right. And check it out. Ace is doing like the metal sign. I've never, ever seen him do that before.
Yeah, wow.
And he's doing like
horns,
the Dio style version of it, you know?
That's awesome. But I just real quick, I want to hear about this photo. We're going to have Jim Bakke on from the band Hitman. He is coming on in just a few minutes. And Hitman, if you don't know, their music is featured in Stranger Things, a show that I just love. We're going to talk to him all about that and about the return of the great classic metal band Hitman. But John, first, before we start discussing this, is this a private photo or can I post this on TalkingMetal.com?
This is a private photo, but okay. I am going to, for the first time, give permission to have this private photo posted on TalkingMetal.com. Okay.
And this was a surprise.
No one has seen this yet.
Yeah, John just shot this to me. This is, again, Rob Halford and Ace. Where was this taken? What's the history
behind this?
This
was taken in Phoenix, Arizona. Now, I think Rob might live in San Diego where Ace lives, but maybe not. Somebody had told me Rob lives in San Diego. I don't know. Do you know where he lives right now?
I believe he always used to be Arizona. I don't know for sure, but I believe it's probably still Arizona. But
yeah,
I
bet
know.
It's Arizona. Maybe the person who told me that he was in San Diego was incorrect, or maybe he has a second place out there. But anyway, this picture was in Phoenix, Arizona, and it was during the sound check for the Alice Cooper's Christmas Pudding event that happened back in December, and that's a great concert that Alice puts on every year, and he includes a bunch of amazing musicians, including Rob Halford of Judas Priest and Ace Frehley. And it was a great event, and that was a photo that Ace had on his cell phone. So let's post this, in the show notes for today's episode of Talking Metal.
Yes,
and it's a really cool shot. I mean, how cool is that?
That
Rob
is awesome.
And Ace together.
Yeah. Yeah, that is so awesome. And you took that or?
No, I didn't take that. Ace texted that to me.
Okay.
I've been so crazed with touring and with my day-to-day work back here in the East Coast that I set that event up and believe it or not, I was opening for Winger actually with Like It the day before this or the day after this event happened. So it was
Right.
It was really, it would have been really difficult for me to get out to the event. But
if you don't
I did,
know, Guys Like It is John's band. We've spoken about that before. But if you're a new listener, Like It is the band that John plays with. Great band. Definitely check them out. What's the web address, John?
Like It or like-it-online.com.
Right on.
So anyway, yeah, two events I missed only because of being so busy, and I've done a couple of Ace events. So Ace has been super busy. First, he has the Alice Cooper Christmas Pudding. Then we did a 3-day run in Texas, in San Antonio, Houston, and Dallas. That was great. A lot of great bands were down there. We played like 2 or 3 gigs with a bunch of great bands like LA Guns, Enough's Enough, Chip's Enough has become one of my best friends. He's great. A lot of bands. Stephen Piercy, I believe, was down there. Maybe not. No, not Stephen Piercy. Don Dokken. Cool. Dokken played, and he was very cool. And just a lot of great people were involved with these gigs. I saw Jason McMaster from Dangerous Toys. Cool. They played on one of the gigs. There was a couple of
supposed
festivals
to be calling in to Talking Metal, hopefully this week.
Oh, nice.
So that we'll post that soon. Yeah.
Cool. Yeah, a lot of great stuff. Another thing happened. Then Ace did the Winter Classic NHL hockey event on New Year's Day, and that was at Citi Field in Queens, New York. And let me tell you a little bit about that. We had a sound check the night before in like literally 0-degree weather. And so on New Year's Eve, we're out doing a sound check. And then New Year's Day morning, we had to get right back out to Citi Field. And it was amazing. Ace played New York Groove completely live. There was a ton of pyro. There's a bunch of different versions of this floating around, but you can get the gist of it when you see it on YouTube. And Ace did a great interview with the NHL guys, and the teams came out. Ace was like fist bumping like the New York Rangers and stuff, and Ace had a Rangers shirt. Now, here's the crazy thing that happened. There's a couple of videos that you can see where at one point Ace, and we didn't tell the producers this, he goes up, and I run up to the stage, and he hands me his light guitar, and I think I'm holding another one of his guitars at the time. And cool. And he takes his coat off, and underneath his leather jacket, he has a Rangers jersey. Now, what happened was I took a step back and didn't realize that I was right nearly on top of one of these, like, flash pots or flame-throwing flash pots or whatever they are. We nearly had one of those unfortunate incidents where someone gets caught in one of those, similar to James Hetfield.
Yeah.
Thank God I didn't, but the flames were so hot that people, you know, in the stands could feel the flames. So I was like right in between the flames, nearly hit by one. So that was not the NHL's fault. Let me say that was my fault, because I was instructed not to go where I did. And we had this like secret clothing change that we did, which was totally cool because the fans went crazy when Ace took off his coat and he had the Ranger jersey that said Fraley and 27.
Awesome.
People were wondering what's 27. That's Ace's birthday, 4/27, April 27th, and 27th is his lucky number. You can see it on the blimp and the cover of Origins, and so that was a great event. And then Ace goes out and just yesterday jams with Gene at Gene Simmons' Vault Experience at I believe Capitol Records Studios in LA, and that was awesome. Eric Singer was there, Bruce Kulick was there, Brent Woods, who plays with Sebastian and a bunch of other people, was the audio engineer on that. So it was just a great event
cool.
put together from Gene and his Vault team, which includes Keith and a bunch of other great people. So anyway, lots of stuff. And then Ace is going to be back on the East Coast for 3 shows in New York and New Jersey coming up February 1, 2, and 3. So if you can get...
Yeah, I'm coming, man. I'm coming. You said I can come to the Englewood show, right?
I did. And guess who else is going to probably come to that show? Dan Lorenzo.
Oh, cool. And Emily, my wife, as most of you guys know Emily, but I hate to put you on the spot here. We haven't spoken about this, but she said... if there's anything you can do to get her a picture with Ace, she would be so incredible.
Yeah, she's got it. She's got
so
it. No
grateful
problem.
Because she's mad at me because we didn't get a photo with him. I've taken her to see Ace many times, and I've never gotten a photo of her and him together.
Definitely get a photo.
If that can happen, you know, whatever it takes, just let me know. Man.
Guess what? I got to tell you, I have some stuff. I even looked up pronunciation on this. Before we get into the interview, I'm drinking a beer, and I believe it's called Zwix. I'm gonna hear the pronunciation one more time, then I will say it. So stand by. Stand by.
All right.
Zwix.
Zwix.
Zwix. It's Z Y W I E C. It's Polish. Polish's or Poland's. It's a Polish beer, and it's noted by some to be Poland's number one beer. So cool. If you're from Poland and you're listening to Talking Metal, tell us how to pronounce Zwicz, and if it is in fact considered Poland's number one beer. I'm drinking that.
Let us know.
And if that's not enough, I have 400 milliliter bottles of Glenmorangie. Your pronunciation is emphasis.
Is that a Scotch? What is that?
Scotch. Yeah. It's, so right now, the one I'm drinking is a 12-year-old Highland single malt Scotch whiskey. It says the Quint. I don't know. It looks like La Quinta, like Quinta Ruban Port Cask finish. So I'm drinking two things. I had it all ready for today's episode: the Zwicz beer. And this special scotch that has the word La Quinta in it.
Right.
Like the hotel.
Talking Metal style. Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyways, yeah, I'm not drinking anything exciting. I have some Perrier water here, wimpy, but.
Oh, that sounds good, though. That's healthy.
Yeah, well, I'm going to have a drink later for sure. But
oh, I got the Iron Maiden beer, by the way.
Oh, dude, yeah, I have one right in my fridge.
Who would you say is better, the Iron Maiden beer or the Megadeth beer?
Ooh, you know. They're both a different taste. I like them both, and I'm not just saying that because it's Megadeth and Iron Maiden. The Tout Le Monde beer and the Trooper beer about. Yeah, both very good, both different tastes.
Okay. Mm,
I might lean slightly towards the Megadeth one, although...
Wow, yeah, I've got to try that. I've got to get it.
Yeah, you know, the Anthrax one, which is very hard to find, I did find a six-pack of that, was definitely my favorite. And there is a Mastodon beer, too, which I drank out at a Duff's bar in Brooklyn.
I'd love to go there someday. I've never been to Duff's bar. I have a patch that says Duff's, but
we should definitely.
Never been to Duff's.
You know, let's do it. Anyways, I got to get into this interview, John, and we're going to do another episode with you right now, so we'll post that in a few days, but... A big thanks to Chip for lining up the Scott Travis interview. Definitely support Judas Priest.
Chipster.
Yeah, Chipster. And let's right now speak with Jim Bakke from the band Hitman. That's two T's in Hitman. And we'll first hear some of their music. This is all classic music by Hitman going way back to the 80s. Dead on Arrival. And then we'll end today's show after the interview with a song called Metal Sport as featured in Stranger Things, the hit Netflix TV show. So, yeah, let's check out Jim right now. And a big thanks to Jim for coming on Talking Metal. Guys, support what we do here by using the Amazon links. And there's the PayPal donation tab. You can use that, too. It's just my email, striglemark@gmail.com, striglemark@gmail.com. Show your support, and when you see Ace in concert, make sure you track down John and say hello.
Yes, absolutely. I met a bunch of great friends of mine in Texas on the last run. I'm getting to know people in different towns, so it's really cool, guys. If you're at one of these Ace shows, ask, you know, even if you don't know me, go up to somebody who looks like they work there and say you'd like to talk to the tour manager, John Ostrowski, or Ostronomy, however you want to say it, and they will track me down, and I'll come out and say hello, for sure.
All right, guys, here's a little Hitman, followed by my interview with Jim from Hitman. Remember to go to the show notes, talkingmetal.com will take you directly there. You will see the picture John just texted me of Rob Halford and Ace Frehley, and you will also see a picture of me and Scott Travis taken in the Epic Record building during the or right after the interview that you heard earlier in the episode. That does it, and at least for us, there's still, you know, a good 40 minutes left here with with
we're
Jim.
We're gonna be
this
not talking for a little while, but make sure you listen to the great interview and the music that comes before and after.
Right on. Here we go. We'll be right back. Hey, it's Mark Striegel from the Talking Metal Podcast and calling in on the line from the classic band Hitman, Jim Bakke. Jim, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm great. And I got a crazy story I got to tell you that involves Hitman, your band, and the TV show Stranger Things, which I'll tell you that in a little bit. But first, let's introduce anyone who might not know the classic band Hitman to the Talking Metal listeners, because you guys weren't exactly mainstream back in the day, but you put out some great music, and if anybody was not aware of you, which I'm sure there are a lot of people that are listening to this show who were not, let's just talk a little bit about the history of the band and, you know, just a general, let's say a general 2 to 3 minute history lesson in the band Hitman.
Okay. Hitman started in 1985. Myself and the late, great Michael Buccellato, AKA Mike Bucell, who was the bassist. We started the group. We had played in a couple of groups previous, one group called Attila, who put out a record. We left and to do Hitman. Started in 1985. We got drummer Chuck Corey, who was in the band Takashi, another Long Island metal band. And we got a then unknown, very young singer named Dirk Kennedy, who sang with Anthrax very early on for about 5 minutes. And I guess back in the day, we used that, you know, we used that probably more than we should have. It is worth mentioning because it did happen, but it was very brief when he was a youngster. We did a demo tape in 1985, five-song demo. I was really into the European underground metal scene. So, like, anybody from England, you know, new wave of British heavy metal, that was kind of, I grew up with that, you know. And that was, you know, we were into the European sound, Judas Priest, Iron Maiden, you know, that kind of thing. We loved Kiss, of course, as did everybody. And, we wanted to make a band that had the, you know, the musical intensity of a Judas Priest or an Iron Maiden, and a show that would kind of be, you know, not on the Kiss level, but we were influenced by, we wanted to put on a great show. So that was kind of the building blocks of the band. We did a demo in 1985. We sent it to a bunch of, you know, Euro magazines, Metal Forces, which gave us a great review and found us a real champion writer named Dave Reynolds, who loved us and wrote great things about us. And we became kind of big in the tape trading circles. That's kind of how we got any sort of notoriety over in Europe. Our first show was opening for Stryper on the To Hell with the Devil tour at Nassau Community College, and it was a sold-out show. And, you know, we were off and running. We were playing Lamar East after that and headlining and playing to 1,000 people. And, you know, that's kind of how we got our start. We always, you know, we struggled trying to get the record deal, though. We wanted to get the big record deal. We ended up getting a SPV. Germany signed us. But they opened up our manager said, if you open up an American division, so we have an American deal, we'll sign with you. So they did. Long story short, we made a record. Part of it was made before we signed with them, and then we finished it when we signed the deal. We made a record the day our record was supposed to come out. The guys running the office in the USA decided, you know, called up SPV and said, we're taking the money and leaving. So the day our record was supposed to come out, that happened, and, you know, the proverbial crap hit the fan. Our record ended up getting licensed to Roadrunner, who we had spoken to in the past, and we didn't want to do a deal with them.
Licensed to Roadrunner, did that take some time? Did it then get shelved for a while before it came out on Roadrunner?
Well, I would say it got delayed, shelved, but delayed, but not that long. I mean, they basically licensed it without asking our permission or getting our permission or anything. So we were just like, we don't want to be on Roadrunner. We talked to them, you know, we didn't think they were the right label for us. And at that time, our singer, Dirk, had gone around and he knew some label people, and he had gotten some interested major labels, Polygram and Atco, I think, was one. And Polygram was really interested in signing the band, and we had to wait for all that to spin out. And, of course, SPV got greedy and asked for like $1 million for our record.
Oh, my
and
God.
And Polygram was just like, yeah, you know, 1988 money. Think about that. So Polygram was just like, man, we can't spend $1 million as a baby band. They haven't even the records. I mean, the record did come out on Roadrunner eventually. The song Will You Be There was like number one on the CMJ charts the week it came out. And here we are, you know, sitting on this like opportunity, but we don't want to work with the label. And
what was, you know, your main problem with Roadrunner? Why didn't you want to work with them? Because, I mean, Roadrunner, they were a pretty respected metal label back in those days.
Yeah, I think we were just, you know, from the deal that we had spoken to them about, we were like, oh, we don't want to be part of that. I don't remember the exact reason. It's a long time ago, but right. we were mostly mad because, you know, we had this whole deal set up with STV, and all of a sudden, they just gave our record away to Roadrunner, and we were like, eh, we don't want to be on Roadrunner. And then we went to, you know, get a bigger deal, and then they asked for all this money, and it was like, you know, and it basically halted us in our tracks. But for the 3 years previous to that, you know, 85 to 88, we were playing big shows. We opened for Stryper twice. We opened for Fate's Warning, for Saxon up in New Haven at the big Agora Ballroom. Killer Dwarves. We played with a lot of cool people, and we were doing really great. It's just that we hit that business stumble that kind of we never really recovered from. And then the business changed, you know, the music changed. It got
right.
The heavier bands got super heavy, and then it was, you know, either you were super heavy thrash or you were glam. And we were kind of like in that middle area. And, you know, we struggled with that for a while, and then we eventually did a second record in like 91, but we were all over the place musically. We were one time sounding very commercial and then one time sounding very progressive. And that record came out in 93, and we went and toured in Germany for a little bit. And, but you know, again, grunge, you know, and there it was gone, you know? Right. So that's kind of the brief history. What happened, you know, we did have a really great second record, like halfway written. That would have been amazing had we gotten to do it. We just didn't get to do it, you know.
Okay. So the first album that came out on Roadrunner is the self-titled Hitman record. But then you mentioned this second record that came out, you said you recorded it in 91. It came out in 1993. That was Viva's Machine, was it? Is that?
Viva's Machina, yeah.
Oh, okay. Oh, Vivus Machina.
Yeah.
Okay, mm-hmm. I'm reading it wrong. But, okay, so that record, but you said there was another second record that wasn't Vivus Machina that you guys had done, or were working on at least.
Well, yeah, we had this whole kind of, as the first album was, you know, going through, it's, as we were done with the first album and it was going into, you know, manufacturing or whatever, we had started writing these tunes, and you know, we were really in, we really liked the whole concept thing that Queensryche were doing, and we kind of came, you know, did a similar thing, but we were, you know, we kind of went a little heavier and a little more progressive,
right?
And that record, we had about five or so songs written, and it was a really great direction for the band. And then we got into the whole business struggle and trying to get a record deal. And you know what happens when you just solely exist to try and get a record deal, you do stupid things. You write stupid songs. And we kind of went down a bad path, and we also got mired in that legal stuff. The label Polygram said, well, don't work that record on Roadrunner because we're trying to buy it. And you know, all of a sudden you got people and lawyers telling you not to do stuff. And we're, you know, that's the death of a band. When you wait around for the business to take care of you, that's what kills a band, you know?
Right.
And we stayed together a long time, but it was just a series of bad luck and circumstances.
So when did you guys break up?
Uh, we never really officially broke up. We just kind of stopped playing. I went on and did other other bands and other music. I eventually moved to Los Angeles in 1995, which is where I still live. Well, I live in Orange County now. And everybody just kind of went on with their lives. I continued to do music. Dirk has continued to do music. He made a solo record, you know, probably 8 years ago. And everybody else just kind of didn't do that much music. They did stuff, but nothing really, they didn't really go for it. They went on with their lives, had kids, et cetera, et cetera. So we never really broke up, and we're still very much a family and close and all that stuff. And then, you know, our bass player passed away tragically in 2013.
I'm so sorry.
So we went to the funeral. Thanks. We went to the funeral and said, you know, we should really do something. We should, you know, reissue the first record and maybe get together and do something. There's audience. And, I never really kept in touch with the metal audience. I kind of got into different music. But Dirk always, the fans always found Dirk, you know, because we were very popular in, like, Germany and, you know, those places where SPV was and that type of music, you know, that type of metal was remained popular. So, like, in Germany and Greece, places like that, apparently we have a pretty, you know, cult audience.
Right.
Which is, you know, I was pretty shocked. Keep It True asked us to play 10 years ago, and I just didn't want to do it. A couple of the other guys didn't want to do it. We actually got added to the flyer, and then they had to take us off because I think Dirk might have said, yeah, I'll get them to do it. And I'm not sure what happened there, but I was like, I wasn't interested in doing it at the time. But, you know, after we lost Mike, you know, this opportunity came up this year again, and you know, Oliver from Keep It True said, hey, you know, I'd still love to have you guys. And I was just like, okay. It's 30 years, you know, it's like 30 year anniversary of the album this year. I was like, let's do it. So, No Remorse, the label and, that reissued our record, you know, hit us up and said, hey, we'd love to reissue the Hitman album with a big full colored booklet and the demo, if you have the demo. So I was like, yeah. So that's what we're up to now. We're doing, cool. You know, I actually had the master for the demo and I remixed it.
Oh, nice.
Because it was always sounded a little cruddy, yeah. And the great thing about the demo is that the demo was only tape traded, so it was cassette to cassette. And so people that had that demo literally had, like, sometimes fifth generation cassette copies of that demo. So this is a treat for them. That demo, we found one on eBay that went for $400 and something for the cassette.
Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah, I was just like, I think I have one at home. So, I said, well, we found those tapes. And I was like, Dirk, send me that tape. I'm going to remix it and, you know, make it sound better. So that's, you know, that's what we did. We have this reissued 30th anniversary with the demo, original demo, which is kind of what got us really started, especially in Europe. So, and that's where we're at now.
Nice. Now so Mike passed away tragically, you said, but besides that, the lineup that people are going to see at Keep It True is the original members, correct? I mean, it's all original members except for you know, Mike, who is no longer with us. So who's right. joining you on bass?
Oddly enough, a guy who I met when I was about 15, I used to jam with his older brother. And his older brother, I used to go to their place and jam. And his older brother used to tell me, oh, you got to hear this guy, Mike. He has this band, Resurrection, and he learned the entire Rush Hemispheres album the day it came out. And, well, he told me about this guy, Mike. Well, ended up being Mike, our Mike. His younger brother plays bass, and we all used to hang out and, you know, and jam and all that stuff. His younger brother lives out here, and I reached out to him, and I saw that he had started playing again. And I said, hey, man, we're going to go do the show over in Europe. You know, as you know, Mike is gone. Would you be interested in playing bass? And, you know, he used to go sit and watch Mike play in his bedroom when he was, you know, in junior high school and high school. So he knows Mike before I know, Mike. So kind of a weird little serendipitous thing, you know.
Right.
He's going to do this gig, and we're going to see what happens, because his name is Greg Beer, and he plays in a band here called, he's got a band here called Power. Kind of a, sort of like, not as heavy as Hitman, but the same sort of 80s hard rock metal type of sound. He's been living out here a long time, but yeah, he was like, oh, I'd be honored. You know, he goes, I'm no Mike, but I could do the part. So I'm like, cool. You know, and the thing about Mike was he was a huge personality. If you've ever seen any of the live, whatever live videos there are, he was, all over the stage. He was a big part of the live experience of Hitman, because he was just really crazy, you know, really crazy. Loved Steve Harris and Gene Simmons, and those are his role models, you know. Yeah. So that we have as of now, Greg, this guy Greg Beer, who's an old friend of ours, an old friend of Mike's. So
cool, guys. We are talking with Jim from the band Hitman. They were a New York heavy metal hard rock band from back in the day, and they are back. And they're doing the Keep It True Festival. If you're going to that, definitely make sure you see their set. And their self-titled original record, which Jim has explained, sounds like the release was a bit botched, if you will. It's now has been re-released, and No Remorse Records is who released it. And Jim, where's the best place people can get it? Is it like up on Spotify and iTunes? And is there a website you can buy the physical copy?
Yeah, the No Remorse Records website, I don't know the exact web address, but if you Google No Remorse Records and Hitman, it'll come up.
Cool.
I just got the record distributed through I should be on iTunes within the next couple days.
Okay.
And then Amazon and all those. You know, it takes a little bit of time to get to the system, but yeah, it's up for sale digitally now as well. So.
And we heard earlier in the program the song Dead on Arrival, which is, of course, a classic song by Hitman, which you can now get this reissued version of. Are they remastered to the tunes? Did you go? I know you remixed the demo, but as far as the self-titled album goes, was there anything you did to that?
No, because what we did use was the... someone had gotten us a long time ago. Somebody went to Japan and got me the Japanese release of that album. And the mastering on that was way better than the American version. So I'm glad I had that, because I put it on and I told Dirk, I said, man, the Japanese version sounds amazing. Do you have it? And he said, yeah. I said, well, we don't have to touch this. It sounds perfect. So,
cool.
I mean, it's a very 80s sounding record, you know.
Yeah.
When you listen to it, it's very much a time capsule. I mean, the exploding snare drum, you know, gated reverb and all that, you know. I wish we could have remixed that too. I think I would have done it some justice, but it is what it is, and it's, you know, it stands as it stands. So there you go.
Absolutely. No, I think it sounds great. And I personally love all those old sounds, and I hate it when bands, I mean, Megadeth controversially went back and re-recorded and remixed a lot of their older stuff. And I got to tell you, I don't like the new versions of it. I like it to be authentic, and that includes, even if you have stuff like gated reverb or too much reverb or whatever, it just brings you back to that time. And I'm very much against messing with the old recordings that we grew up with. So I'm glad that it's still the same mix and everything. Now let's get into the hit TV show that everyone is talking about, Stranger Things. Everywhere. This is just a phenomenon, this show. People are calling it the best show in years. And this is a true story, which just really kind of freaked me out, because my wife and I were, I guess you'd call it, like binge watching season two. And one night we did about two or three episodes one night, and we stopped after, I think it was season two, episode five. This is maybe a month or so ago. And there was a song that I heard when this guy, I think his name's Billy, he's Max's older brother, pulls up in his sports car, the Trans Am or whatever it is. And there was this music blaring out of the car. And I said to my wife, I was like, what is that? What is that music? I should know that, because a lot of the metal stuff they play on there, I recognize and I know. But it was driving me nuts all day. The next day, I was thinking, damn, who was that that played in that car? I didn't get as far as Googling it, which probably would have given me the answer. But I didn't go that far. But it was definitely on my mind. I was definitely thinking about it. And that night, I log into Facebook, and there's this message from you. And it was really just such a bizarre coincidence, because I'd been thinking kind of a little bit about that song all day. And here you are saying, oh, yeah, I'm from the band Hitman. We were a New York hard rock heavy metal band. Oh, and by the way, one of our songs was used in Stranger Things, which you said something like, I think that might, which I guess is a big deal. And then I said, yeah. Was it episode 5 from season 2? And you responded, yes. So it was just really kind of weird, because I couldn't believe it, because the whole day I kind of had it on my mind, like, oh, I gotta Google that and find out who that was. And I was a little ashamed I didn't know who it was. But so, yeah, it was really a very odd coincidence that same day that I'm thinking about this song, trying to figure out who it was, the guy who made the song reaches out to me on Facebook. So it's just random. Very, very strange. And I swear to God, funny. That's a true story. That's a true story. So,
oh my God.
Yeah. How did that happen? You guys got a song placed in the biggest TV show of 2017. How did that happen?
Well, unbeknownst to me, because I had no idea how big the show was. I basically, for the last 15 years, that's kind of what I've been doing for a living, is I make music, and I have guys that are music consultants, and they get placements in TV shows,
okay,
films, commercials, what have you. That's kind of what I've been doing for the last 15 years. And you know, it's this one consultant I work with is a friend of mine. We're really good friends now. We basically kind of kept each other's lights on for the last 15 years, you know, him getting me placements, and, you know, we both do great off of it. He started focusing on period correct period music. That's anything that's, because a lot of TV shows, like, for instance, Mad Men, right? They
sure.
They only wanted music from the era. They didn't want music that sounded like it was from the era. It actually had to be from the era. So, of course, a lot of that stuff is super expensive.
Yeah.
So he basically said, hey, if you have any of your old band's material, you know, that 80s band you were in, send it to me. He's like, a lot of people are looking for period music. You know, it's got to be from the period. It can't be sound alike period. It's got to be. So I said, man, the Hitman stuff is about as 80s as it gets. I'll send it to you. And he's gotten me a few placements over the years. This one, I think he might have told me about it. I mean, I had no idea how big the show was. All of a sudden, my phone kind of blew up with people like, I heard Hitman on Stranger Things.
Right.
And yeah, oddly enough, they used the demo. They used the demo version, not the album version.
Wow. Okay.
Which is even funnier, because if you watch that scene, right before they show the scene with the car, they have that weird backwards drum thing when the two people are talking. That's the beginning of Metal Sport. We did the intro with backwards drums, which we later hated.
Yeah.
So we did it front ways on the album. But so it kind of exits out of that scene with that backwards drum intro, and then, you know, they're blasting Metal Sport out of the car. I had no idea. I'd never even heard of the show. You know, and all of these people are like, oh my God, I heard you on Stranger Things. I'm like, what? And I called him up, and he's like, yeah, I got that. It's like the biggest show right now. He's like, yeah, my daughter watches it. Everybody knows it. My kids watch it. I watch it with my kids.
Right.
I had no idea. So yeah. I was like, oh, wow. And that's the week that record came out. The re-release came out October 31st.
Wow, good timing. So, nice.
Yeah, really good timing, I'd say. So that's how that happened. And there are going to be some more Hitman placements, because now people are, not from that, but just because I guess 80s is a popular theme in, you know, TV now, with these TV shows, they're doing
sure.
80s retro. So there you go. Hopefully it'll continue. And you know, we'll get a little something out of it, you know.
Very good. And we are going to play that song for the Talking Metal listeners in just a bit. We'll make sure we play the demo version, as you mentioned. I think that was part of the tracks that you sent me over. So I'll make sure we play the demo version of it. The song, you mentioned it, Metal Sport, an early Hitman song off of the self-titled record and the first demo. And just great stuff. And I'm so glad you reached out, and I'm so glad I was able to discover Hitman, because I do remember the name from back in the day, but I can't specifically say that I was well versed on you guys when I was a teenage metalhead. So better late than never.
Yeah, I think we were probably playing the clubs before you were old enough to go to them.
Okay.
Could you be. Know, 88 85 86 87.
Yeah,
that's kind of when we were really hitting it hard.
Right.
So, yeah.
Well, the thing was, I used to go to the all-age shows. However, I lived in the Midwest until I was done with high school. And then my family moved back to New Jersey, where we had been when I was like in grade school. So yeah, we were back here in like late 87, early 88 is when we kind of moved back into this area. So,
Yeah. That was, we were playing around there, but you were probably still too young to be going to stuff. To regular rock. I think the drinking age had changed to 21 at that point.
Yes, definitely. Now, you mentioned you did shows at Lemoore's East. How many Lemoore's were there? Was it two or three back in the day?
There were three. There was Lemoore Brooklyn, of course, and then Lemoore East, and then there was, for a while, Lemoore Far East, which was out where I lived in Long Island.
Okay.
And that eventually changed names to Showcase, but it was Lemoore Far East for a while.
So there was Lemoore Brooklyn.
That one didn't.
Then there was Lemoore, the other Lemoore, yeah. Lemoore East. What was that, Staten Island?
That was in Queens, on
that
Queens
was in Queens.
Boulevard.
Okay, all right, okay.
And that was the biggest one. It was a bigger club than the Brooklyn club. It was, you know, you'd get, I mean, I saw lots of stuff. There's Quiet Riot in there. There's Queensryche in there. You know, lots of, we opened up for Seduce the first time we played there.
Seduce out of Detroit. Out of Michigan, right?
Yeah, and oddly enough, I became friends with Chuck Burns a couple of years ago, the drummer, through the whole tiki thing that I'm into, and he's into that. And I was like, dude, I opened up for you in 1985. I was like, I remember that show.
Wow.
So, yeah, weird worlds, they collide in weird ways. But you know, Lemoore East was a really big, and that was always known more as the glam Lemoore's, which it really wasn't, but you know, Lemoore Brooklyn's where all the heavy, like, thrash bands played. So everyone said, there was always that rivalry of, oh, you play the Poser Lemoore's. It's like, you know what? That's in our neighborhood, man. That's
right.
Where we played. It had a big stage. It had great lights. You know, back then it was, you know, that kind of, well, you're a Poser, you know, that whole
right.
thing.
Okay, well, before I let you go. Before I let you go, Jim, let's talk mm-hmm. about what's up next for Hitman. You guys are working on new material, is that right?
We are. You know, we're in different states, so myself and Dirk both have recorded stuff, records on our own. So we just, when this whole Keep It True thing came up and the re-release came up, I was like, hey, why don't we do some new stuff?
Cool.
And he's like, okay, I said, all right, so let's talk about what the new material's going to be like, because, you know, we always got tagged for sounding like Queensryche, and it's kind of inescapable. We have that, you know, that kind of style. But I said, let's really focus on, like, what made us get together with Hitman in the first place, like what made us want to play metal. So, like, the influences are all classic, you know, Rainbow, you know, Dio-era Sabbath, you know, early Priest, early Iron Maiden,
cool,
you know, that kind of stuff. We're going for the classic metal sound, kind of I'd like to keep it pre-1984 or 5, more like the late 70s, early 80s, kind of new wave of British heavy metal sound.
Nice.
So, yeah, we're doing new material. We got a bunch of stuff written and recorded, demoed right now, and we plan to have it ready for Keep It True, but I don't think it's going to be. We'll probably have some sort of two-song single-type release for that.
Okay,
and then, yeah, so hopefully Keep It True will kind of give us a little boost over there. We can get more of those festival shows. There's a lot of them. I want to be in on that. You know, I want to be right. playing those kind of shows.
Cool. Well, so, best of luck to you, man. Yeah, it's been great talking with you and getting educated on Hitman, the classic heavy metal band from the 1980s. They're still here. They are producing new music. They're doing Keep It True. Do you think there could be dates in the States or no?
Well, right now the plan is, my plan is, I don't want to go to play Keep It True without having done any sort of warm-up show. And that makes it a little tough because our drummer's in Vegas. I'm here in Southern California. The other two guys are in New York, and the bass player's here.
Wow.
But I told them, I said, the week before we go to Keep It True, you know, why don't we just all go to New York, play a show for our old friends, and that'll be our warm-up show a couple days before we fly. We can fly out from New York to Germany. So that's the plan I have in my head right now, which I hope happens, because I know a lot of our friends would love to see us again. And, of course, you will be on the guest list.
Oh, awesome.
And hopefully you can make it.
I'd love to. Please keep me posted. Yeah, give me a couple weeks' notice, and I will be there. Thanks for coming on and talking with us here on Talking Metal. Guys, this is the band Hitman. The song is called Metal Sport, as heard on the great show Stranger Things, a part of season 2. And again, the album has been re-released and the demo remixed. So definitely check it out. No Remorse Records has re-released Hitman. We're going to have the links up in today's show notes that'll take you right over to No Remorse Records, where you can purchase a copy of the Hitman self-titled re-release record. And of course, check it out on iTunes and Spotify and Amazon and all that too. Jim, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.